I am heir to the crossing. You can't.
I warned you about talking. Jamie watched the man turn white. A sot, a fool, and a craven. Lord Walder had best outlive this one, or the frays are done.
You are dismissed, sir. Dismissed. You heard me. Go away. But where should I go?
To hell or home, as you prefer.
See that you are not in camp when the sun comes up. You may take your queen of whores, but not that crown of hers.
Jamie turned from Sir Ryman to his son.
Edwin, I am giving you your father's command. Try not to be so stupid as your sire.
That ought not to pose much difficulty, my lord.
Send word to Lord Walder. The crown requires all his prisoners.
Jamie waved his golden hand.
Sir Lyle, bring him.
Edmure Tully had collapsed face down on the scaffold when Sir Ilyn's blade sheared the rope in two. A foot of hemp still dangled from the noose about his neck. Strongbow grabbed the end of it and pulled him to his feet.
A fish on a leash, he said, chortling. There's a sight I never saw before.
The frays stepped aside to let them pass. A crowd had gathered below the scaffold, including a dozen camp followers in various states of disarray. Jamie noticed one man holding a wood harp.
You, singer, come with me.
The man doffed his hat, as my lord commands. No one said a word as they walked back to the ferry with Sir Ryman's singer trailing after them. But as they shoved off from the riverbank and made for the south side of the Tumblestone, Edmure Tully grabbed Jamie by the arm.
Why?
A Lannister pays his debts, he thought, and you're the only coin that's left to me.
Consider it a wedding gift.
Edmure stared at him with wary eyes.
Wedding gift?
I'm told your wife is pretty. She'd have to be, for you to better while your sister and your king were being murdered.
I never knew.
Edmure licked his cracked lips.
There were fiddlers outside the bedchamber.
And Lady Roslyn was distracting you.
They made her do it. Lord Walder and the rest. Roslyn never wanted.
She wept, but I thought it was... The sight of your rampant manhood? Aye, that would make any woman weep, I'm sure.
She's carrying my child.
No, Jamie thought. That's your death she has growing in her belly. Back at his pavilion, he dismissed Strongbore and Sir Ilyn, but not the singer.
I may have need of a song shortly, he told the man.
Lou, heat some bath water for my guest.
Pia, find him some clean clothing.
Nothing with lions on it, if you please.
Peck, wine for Lord Tully.
Are you hungry, my lord?
Edmure nodded, but his eyes were still suspicious.
Jamie settled on a stool while Tully had his bath. The filth came off in grey clouds.
Once you've eaten, my men will escort you to River Run.
What happens after that is up to you.
What do you mean?
Your uncle is an old man. Valiant, yes, but the best part of his life is done. He has no bride to grieve for him, no children to defend. A good death is all the Blackfish can hope for. But you have years remaining, Edmure. And you are the rightful lord of House Tully, not him. Your uncle serves at your pleasure. The fate of River Run is in your hands.
Edmure stared. The fate of River Run?
Yield the castle, and no one dies. Your small folk may go in peace or stay to serve Lord Emon. Sir Brynden will be allowed to take the Black, along with as many of the garrison as choose to join him. You as well, if the wall appeals to you. Or you may go to Casterly Rock as my captive and enjoy all the comforts and courtesy that befits a hostage of your rank. I'll send your wife to join you, if you like. If her child is a boy, he will serve House Lannister as a page and a squire, and when he earns his knighthood, we'll bestow some lands upon him. Should Roslyn give you a daughter, I'll see her well dowered when she's old enough to wed. You yourself may even be granted parole once the war is done. All you need do is yield the castle.
Edmure raised his hands from the tub and watched the water run between his fingers. And if I will not yield?
Must you make me say the words?
Pia was standing by the flap of the tent with her arms full of clothes.
His squires were listening as well, and the singer.
Let them hear, Jamie thought. Let the world hear. It makes no matter.
He forced himself to smile.
You've seen our numbers, Edmure. You've seen the ladders, the towers, the trebuchets, the rams.
If I speak the command, my Kuz will bridge your moat and break your gate. Hundreds will die, most of them your own. Your former bannermen will make up the first wave of attackers, so you'll start your day by killing the fathers and brothers of men who died for you at the Twins. The second wave will be Freys. I have no lack of those. My Westermen will follow when your archers are short of arrows and your knights so weary they can hardly lift their blades. When the castle falls, all those inside will be put to the sword. Your herds will be butchered, your godswood will be felled, your keeps and towers will burn. I'll pull your walls down and divert the tumblestone over the ruins. By the time I'm done, no man will ever know that a castle once stood here. Jamie got to his feet. Your wife may help before that. You'll want your child, I expect. I'll send him to you, when he's born, with a trebuchet. Silence followed his speech. Edmure sat in his bath. Pia clutched the clothing to her breasts. The singer tightened a string on his harp. Little Lou hollowed out a loaf of stale bread to make a trencher, pretending that he had not heard. With a trebuchet, Jamie thought. If his aunt had been there, would she still say Tyrion was Tywin's son? Edmure Tully finally found his voice. I could climb out of this tub and kill you where you stand, Kingslayer. You could try. Jamie waited. When Edmure made no move to rise, he said, I'll leave you to enjoy your food. Singer, play for our guest whilst he eats. You know the song, I trust. The one about the rain? Aye, my lord, I know it. Edmure seemed to see the man for the first time. No. Not him. Get him away from me. Why, it's just a song, said Jamie. He cannot have that bad a voice.
The Watcher. Let us look upon this head, his prince commanded. Arya Hotar ran his hand along the smooth shaft of his long axe, his ash and iron wife, all the while watching. He watched the White Knight, Sir Balon Swan, and the others who had come with him. He watched the Sand Snakes, each at a different table. He watched the lords and ladies, the serving men, the old blind seneschal, and the young maester, Miles, with his silky beard and servile smile. Standing half in light and half in shadow, he saw all of them. Serve, protect, obey. That was his task. All the rest had eyes only for the chest. It was carved of ebony, with silver clasps and hinges. A fine-looking box, no doubt, but many of those assembled here in the old palace of Sunspear might soon be dead, depending on what was in that chest. His slippers whispering against the floor, Maester Kaliot crossed the hall to Sir Balon Swan. The round little man looked splendid in his new robes, with their broad bands of dun and butternut and narrow stripes of red. Bowing, he took the chest from the hands of the White Knight and carried it to the dais, where Doran Martell sat in his rolling chair between his daughter Arianne and his dead brother's beloved paramour, Elaria. 100 scented candles perfumed the air. Gemstones glittered on the fingers of the lords and the girdles and hairnets of the ladies. Arya Hotar had polished his shirt of copper scales mirror bright, so he would blaze in the candlelight as well. A hush had fallen across the hall. Dawn holds its breath. Maester Kaliot set the box on the floor beside Prince Doran's chair. The maester's fingers, normally so sure and deft, turned clumsy as he worked the latch and opened the lid to reveal the skull within. Hotar heard someone clear his throat. One of the Fowler twins whispered something to the other. Elaria Sand had closed her eyes and was murmuring a prayer. Sir Balon Swan was taut as a drawn bow, the captain of guards observed. This new White Knight was not so tall nor comely as the old one, but he was bigger across the chest, burlier, his arms thick with muscle. His snowy cloak was clasped at the throat by two swans on a silver brooch. One was ivory, the other onyx, and it seemed to Aryabhata as if the two of them were fighting. The man who wore them looked a fighter, too.
"This one will not die so easy as the other. He will not charge into my axe the way Sir Ares did. He will stand behind his shield and make me come at him."
If it came to that, Hotar would be ready. His long axe was sharp enough to shave with. He allowed himself a brief glance at the chest. The skull rested on a bed of black felt, grinning. All skulls grinned, but this one seemed happier than most.
"And bigger."
The captain of guards had never seen a larger skull. Its brow shelf was thick and heavy, its jaw massive. The bone shone in the candlelight, white as Sir Balin's cloak.
"Place it on the pedestal,"
the prince commanded. He had tears glistening in his eyes. The pedestal was a column of black marble, 3 feet taller than Maester Caliot. The fat little maester hopped up on his toes, but still could not quite reach. Aryabhata was about to go and help him, but Obara Sand moved first. Even without her whip and shield, she had an angry, mannish look to her. In place of a gown, she wore men's breeches and a calf-length linen tunic, cinched at the waist with a belt of copper suns. Her brown hair was tied back in a knot. Snatching the skull from the maester's soft pink hands, she placed it up atop the marble column. "The mountain rides no more," the prince said gravely.
"Was his dying long and hard, Sir Balin?" asked Tyene Sand, in the tone a maiden might use to ask if her gown was pretty.
"He screamed for days, milady," the white knight replied, though it was plain that it pleased him little to say so.
"We could hear him all over the Red Keep."
"Does that trouble you, sir?"
asked the Lady Nym. She wore a gown of yellow silk, so sheer and fine that the candles shone right through it to reveal the spun gold and jewels beneath. So immodest was her garb that the white knight seemed uncomfortable looking at her, but Hotar approved. Nymeria was least dangerous when nearly naked. Elsewise, she was sure to have a dozen blades concealed about her person.
"Sir Gregor was a bloody brute. All men agree. If ever a man deserved to suffer, it was him."
"That is as it may be, my lady," said Balin Swan. "But Sir Gregor was a knight, and a knight should die with sword in hand. Poison is a foul and filthy way to kill." Lady Tyene smiled at that. Her gown was cream and green, with long lace sleeves, so modest and so innocent that any man who looked at her might think her the most chaste of maids. Aryabhata knew better. Her soft pale hands were as deadly as Obara's calloused ones, if not more so. He watched her carefully, alert to every little flutter of her fingers. Prince Doran frowned.
"That is so, Sir Balin. But the Lady Nym is right. If ever a man deserved to die screaming, it was Gregor Clegane. He butchered my good sister, smashed her babe's head against a wall. I only pray that now he is burning in some hell, and that Elia and her children are at peace. This is the justice that Dawn has hungered for. I am glad that I lived long enough to taste it. At long last, the Lannisters have proved the truth of their boast and paid this old blood debt."
The prince left it to Ricasso, his blind seneschal, to rise and propose the toast.
"Lords and ladies, let us now drink to Tommen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Ronar, and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms."
Serving men had begun to move amongst the guests as the seneschal was speaking, filling cups from the flagons that they bore. The wine was Dornish strong wine, dark as blood and sweet as vengeance. The captain did not drink of it. He never drank at feasts.
nor did the prince himself partake. He had his own wine, prepared by Maester Miles, and well laced with poppy juice to ease the agony in his swollen joints. The White Knight did drink, as was only courteous, his companions likewise. So did the Princess Ariane, Lady Jourdain, the Lord of God's Grace, the Knight of Lemonwood, the Lady of Ghost Hill, even Hilaria Sand, Prince Oberon's beloved paramour, who had been with him in King's Landing when he died. Hotar paid more note to those who did not drink, Sir Damon Sand, Lord Tremond Gargallon, the Fowler twins, Dagus Manwoody, the Ullers of the Hellholt, the Wills of the Boneware.
If there is trouble, it could start with one of them.
Dorne was an angry and divided land, and Prince Doran's hold on it was not as firm as it might be. Many of his own lords thought him weak, and would have welcomed open war with the Lannisters and the boy king on the Iron Throne. Chief amongst those were the Sand Snakes, the bastard daughters of the prince's late brother Oberyn, the Red Viper, three of whom had been at the feast. Doran Martell was the wisest of princes, and it was not the place of his captain of guards to question his decisions. But Arya Hotar did wonder why he had chosen to release the ladies Obara, Nymeria, and Tyene from their lonely cells in the Spear Tower. Tyene declined Ricasso's toast with a murmur, and Lady Nym with a flick of a hand. Obara let them fill her cup to the brim, then upended it to spill the red wine on the floor. When a serving girl knelt to wipe up the spilled wine, Obara left the hall. After a moment, Princess Ariane excused herself and went after her.
Obara would never turn her rage on the little princess, Hotar knew. They are cousins, and she loves her well.
The feast continued late into the night, presided over by the grinning skull on its pillar of black marble. Seven courses were served, in honour of the seven gods and the seven brothers of the king's god. The soup was made with eggs and lemons, the long green peppers stuffed with cheese and onions. There were lamprey pies, capons glazed with honey, a whisker fish from the bottom of the green blood that was so big it took four serving men to carry it to table. After that came a savoury snake stew, chunks of seven different sorts of snake, slow simmered with dragon peppers and blood oranges and a dash of venom to give it a good bite. The stew was fiery hot, Hotar knew, though he tasted none of it. Sherbet followed to cool the tongue. For the sweet, each guest was served a skull of spun sugar. When the crust was broken, they found sweet custard inside and bits of plum and cherry. Princess Ariane returned in time for the stuffed peppers.
My little princess, Hotar thought.
But Ariane was a woman now. The scarlet silks she wore left no doubt of that. Of late she had changed in other ways as well. Her plot to crown Mycella had been betrayed and smashed. Her white knight had perished bloodily at Hotar's hand, and she herself had been confined to the Spear Tower, condemned to solitude and silence. All of that had chastened her. There was something else as well, though, some secret. Her father had confided in her before releasing her from her confinement. What that was, the captain did not know. The prince had placed his daughter between himself and the White Knight, a place of high honour. Ariane smiled as she slipped into her seat again and murmured something in Sir Balin's ear. The knight did not choose to respond. He ate little, Hotar observed. A spoon of soup, a bite of the pepper, the leg off a capon, some fish. He shunned the lamprey pie and tried only one small spoonful of the stew. Even that made his brow break out in sweat. Hotar could sympathize. When first he came to Dorn, the fiery food would tie his bowels in knots and burn his tongue. That was years ago, however.
Now his hair was white, and he could eat anything a Dornish man could. When the sponge sugar skulls were served, Sir Balin's mouth grew tight, and he gave the prince a lingering look to see if he was being mocked. Doran Martell took no notice, but his daughter did.
"It is the cook's little jeep, Sir Balin," said Ariane. "Even death is not sacred to a Dornishman. You won't be cross with us, I pray."
She brushed the back of the White Knight's hand with her fingers.
"I hope you have enjoyed your time in Dorn."
"Everyone has been most hospitable, milady." Ariane touched the pin that clasped his cloak with its quarrelling swans.
"I have always been fond of swans. No other bird is half so beautiful this side of the Summer Isles."
"Your peacocks might dispute that," said Sir Balin.
"They might," said Ariane, "but peacocks are vain, proud creatures, strutting about in all those gaudy colours. Give me a swan serene in white, or beautiful in black."
Sir Balin gave a nod and sipped his wine.
"This one is not so easily seduced as was his sworn brother," Hotar thought. "Sir Aerys was a boy despite his years. This one is a man and weary."
The captain had only to look at him to see that the White Knight was ill at ease.
"This place is strange to him, and a little to his liking."
Hotar could understand that. Dorne had seemed a queer place to him as well, when first he came here with his own princess many years ago. The bearded priests had drilled him in the common speech of Westeros before they sent him forth, but the Dornish men all spoke too quickly for him to understand. Dornish women were lewd, Dornish wine was sour, and Dornish food was full of queer, hot spices. And the Dornish sun was hotter than the pale one sun of Norvos, glaring down from a blue sky day after day. Sir Balin's journey had been shorter, but troubling in its own way, the captain knew. 3 knights, 8 squires, 20 men-at-arms, and sundry grooms and servants had accompanied him from King's Landing, but once they had crossed the mountains into Dorne, their progress had been slowed by a round of feasts, hunts, and celebrations at every castle they had chanced to pass. And now that they had reached Sunspear, neither Princess Marcella nor Sir Aerys Oakheart was on hand to greet them.
"The White Knight knows that something is amiss," Hotar could tell. "But it is more than that."
Perhaps the presence of the Sand Snakes unnerved him. If so, Obara's return to the hall must have been vinegar in the wound. She slipped back into her place without a word, and sat there sullen and scowling, neither smiling nor speaking. Midnight was close at hand when Prince Doran turned to the White Knight and said, "Sir Balin, I have read the letter that you brought me from our gracious queen. Might I assume that you are familiar with its contents, sir?" Hotar saw the knight tense. "I am, my lord. Her Grace informed me that I might be called upon to escort her daughter back to King's Landing. King Tommen has been pining for his sister and would like Princess Marcella to return to court for a short visit." Princess Ariane made a sad face.
"Oh, but we have all grown so fond of Marcella, sir. She and my brother, Tristain, have become inseparable."
"Prince Tristain would be welcoming King's Landing as well," said Balon Swan. "King Tommen would wish to meet him, I am sure. His Grace has so few companions near his own age."
"The bonds formed in boyhood can last a man for life," said Prince Doran. "When Tristain and Marcella are wed, he and Tommen will be as brothers. Queen Cersei has the right of it. The boys should meet, become friends. Dorne will miss him, to be sure, but it is past time Tristain saw something of the world beyond the walls of Sunspear."
"I know King's Landing will welcome him most warmly."
"Why is he sweating now?" the captain wondered, watching. "The hall is cool enough. But he never touched the stew.
As for the other matter that Queen Cersei raises, Prince Doran was saying,
it is true Dorne's seat upon the small council has been vacant since my brother's death, and it has past time that it was filled again. I am flattered that Her Grace feels my counsel might be of use to her, though I wonder if I have the strength for such a journey. Perhaps if we went by sea...
By ship? Sir Balin seemed taken aback.
Would that be safe, my prince?
Autumn is a bad season for storms, or so I've heard, and the pirates in the Stepstones, they...
The pirates? To be sure, you may be right, sir. Safer to return the way you came.
Prince Doran smiled pleasantly.
Let us talk again on the morrow. When we reach the water gardens, we can tell Marcella. I know how excited she will be. She misses her brother, too, I do not doubt.
I am eager to see her once again, said Sir Balin, and to visit your water gardens. I've heard they are very beautiful.
Beautiful and peaceful, the prince said. Cool breezes, sparkling water, and the laughter of children. The water gardens are my favourite place in this world, sir. One of my ancestors had them built to please his Targaryen bride and free her from the dust and heat of Sunspear. Daenerys was her name. She was sister to King Daeron the Good, and it was her marriage that made Dorne part of the Seven Kingdoms. The whole realm knew that the girl loved Daeron's bastard brother, Daemon Blackfyre, and was loved by him in turn. But the king was wise enough to see that the good of thousands must come before the desires of two, even if those two were dear to him. It was Daenerys who filled the gardens with laughing children, her own children at the start, but later the sons and daughters of lords and landed knights were brought in to be companions to the boys and girls of princely blood. And one summer's day, when it was scorching hot, she took pity on the children of her grooms and cooks and serving men and invited them to use the pools and fountains too, a tradition that has endured to this day. The prince grasped the wheels of his chair and pushed himself from the table. But now you must excuse me, sir. All this talk has wearied me, and we should leave at break of day. Abara, would you be so kind as to help me to my bed? Nymeria, Tyene, come as well, and bid your old uncle a fond good night. So it fell to Abara's hand to roll the prince's chair from Sunspear's feast hall and down a long gallery to his solar. Arya Hotar followed with her sisters, along with Princess Arianne and Ilaria Sand. Maester Caliot hurried behind on slippered feet, cradling the mountain skull as if it were a child. "You cannot seriously intend to send Tristain and Marcella to King's Landing," Obara said as she was pushing.
Her strides were long and angry, much too fast, and the chair's big wooden wheels clacked noisily across rough-cut stone floors.
"Do that, and we will never see the girl again. And your son will spend his life a hostage to the Iron Throne."
"Do you take me for a fool, Abara?" the prince sighed.
"There is much you do not know. Things best not discussed here, where anyone can hear. If you hold your tongue, I may enlighten you." He winced. "Slower, for the love you bear me. Ugh, that last jolt sent a knife right through my knee."
Abara slowed her pace by half. "What will you do, then?" Her sister Tyene gave answer. "What he always does," she purred. "Delay, obscure, prevaricate. Oh, no one does that half so well as our brave uncle."
"You do him wrong," said Princess Arianne. "Be quiet, all of you," the prince commanded.
Not until the doors of his solar were safely closed behind them did he wheel his chair about to face the women. Even that effort left him breathless, and the Mearish blanket
that covered his legs, caught between two spokes as he rolled, so he had to clutch it to keep it from being torn away. Beneath the coverlet, his legs were pale, soft, ghastly. Both of his knees were red and swollen, and his toes were almost purple, twice the size they should have been. Arihotar had seen them 1,000 times, and still found them hard to look upon. Princess Ariane came forward. "Let me help you, father." The prince pulled the blanket free.
"I can still master mine own blanket. That much at least."
It was little enough. His legs had been useless for 3 years, but there was still some strength in his hands and shoulders.
"Shall I fix my prince a thimble cup of milk of the poppy?"
Maester Caliot asked.
"I would need a bucket with this pain. Thank you, but no. I want my wits about me. I'll have no more need of you tonight." "Very good, my prince."
Maester Caliot bowed, Sir Gregor's head still clutched in his soft pink hands.
"I'll take that."
Obaros End plucked the skull from him and held it at arm's length.
"What did the mountain look like? How do we know that this is him? They could have dipped the head in tar. Why strip it to the bone?"
"Tar would have ruined the box," suggested Lady Nim, as Maester Caliot scurried off.
"No one saw the mountain die, and no one saw his head removed. That troubles me, I confess. But what could the Bitch Queen hope to accomplish by deceiving us? If Gregor Clegane is alive, soon or late the truth will out. The man was 8 feet tall. There's not another like him in all of Westeros. If any such appears again, Cersei Lannister will be exposed as a liar before all the Seven Kingdoms. She would be an utter fool to risk that. What could she hope to gain?"
"The skull is large enough, no doubt," said the prince, "and we know that Oberyn wounded Gregor grievously. Every report we have had since claims that Clegane died slowly, in great pain."
"Just as father intended," said Tyene. "Sisters, truly, I know the poison father used. If his spear so much as broke the mountain's skin, Clegane is dead. I do not care how big he was. Doubt your little sister if you like, but never doubt our sire."
Obara bristled.
"I never did, and never shall."
She gave the skull a mocking kiss.
"This is a start, I'll grant."
"A start?" said Ilaria Sand, incredulous. "Gods forbid I would it were a finish. Tywin Lannister is dead. So are Robert Baratheon, Aemory Lorch, and now Gregor Clegane. All those who had a hand in murdering Elia and her children. Even Joffrey, who was not yet born when Elia died. I saw the boy perish with mine own eyes, clawing at his throat as he tried to draw a breath. Who else is there to kill? Do Myrcella and Tommen need to die, so the shades of Rhaenys and Aegon can be at rest? Where does it end?"
"It ends in blood, as it began," said Lady Nim. "It ends when Castle Rock is cracked open, so the sun can shine on the maggots and the worms within. It ends with the utter ruin of Tywin Lannister and all his works." "The man died at the hand of his own son," Ilaria snapped back. "What more could you wish?"
"I could wish that he died at my hand."
Lady Nim settled in a chair, her long black braid falling across one shoulder to her lap. She had her father's widow's peak. Beneath it, her eyes were large and lustrous. Her wine-red lips curled in a silken smile. If he had, his dying would not have been so easy.
"Sir Gregor does look lonely," said Tyene, in her sweet scepter's voice. "He would like some company, I'm certain."
Ilaria's cheeks were wet with tears, her dark eyes shining.
Even weeping, she has the strength in her, the captain thought. Oberon wanted vengeance for Ilya. Now the three of you want vengeance for him. I have four daughters, I remind you. Your sisters. My Ilya is 14, almost a woman. Obella is 12, on the brink of maidenhood. They worship you, as Doria and Noreza worship them. If you should die, must Eel and Obella seek vengeance for you, then Doria and Lori for them? Is that how it goes? Round and round forever. I ask you, where does it end?
Ilaria Sand laid her hand on the mountain's head.
I saw your father die. Here is his killer. Can I take a skull to bed with me, to give me comfort in the night? Will it make me laugh, write me songs, care for me when I am old and sick?
What would you have us do, my lady? Asked Lady Nim. Shall we lay down our spears and smile, and forget all the wrongs that have been done to us?
War will come, whether we wish it or not, said Obara. A boy king sits the Iron Throne. Lord Stannis holds the war and is gathering Northmen to his cause. The two queens are squabbling over Tommen like bitches with a juicy bone. The Iron Men have taken the shields and are raiding up the Mander, deep into the heart of the Reach, which means Highgarden will be preoccupied as well. Our enemies are in disarray. The time is ripe.
Ripe for what? To make more skulls? Ilaria Sand turned to the prince.
They will not see. I can hear no more of this.
Go back to your girls, Ilaria, the prince told her. I swear to you, no harm will come to them.
My prince,
Ilaria kissed him on the brow and took her leave. Arya Hotar was sad to see her go.
She is a good woman.
When she had gone, Lady Nim said, I know she loved our father well, but it is plain she never understood him. The prince gave her a curious look.
She understood more than you ever will, Nymeria. And she made your father happy. In the end, a gentle heart may be worth more than pride or valour. Be that as it may, there are things Ilaria does not know and should not know. This war has already begun.
Obara laughed. Aye, our sweet Ariane has seen to that. The princess flushed, and Hotar saw a spasm of anger pass across her father's face.
What she did as much for you as for herself. I would not be so quick to mock.
That was praise, Obara Sand insisted. Procrastinate, obscure, prevaricate, dissemble, and delay all you like, uncle. Sir Balin must still come face to face with Myrcella at the Water Gardens, and when he does, he's like to see she's short an ear. And when the girl tells him how your captain cut Ares Oakheart from neck to groin with that steel wife of his, well...
No.
Princess Ariane unfolded from the cushion where she sat and put a hand on Hotar's arm.
That wasn't how it happened, cousin. Sir Ares was slain by Geraldine.
The Sand Snakes looked at one another.
Darkstar? Darkstar did it, his little princess said. He tried to kill Princess Myrcella too, as she will tell Sir Balin.
Nim smiled. That part at least is true.
It is all true, said the prince, with a wince of pain. Is it his gout that hurts him, or the lie? And now Sir Gerald has fled back to High Hermitage, beyond our reach.
Darkstar, Tyene murmured with a giggle. Why not? It's all his doing, but will Sir Balin believe it?
He will if he hears it from Myrcella, Ariane insisted.
Obara snorted in disbelief. She may lie today and lie tomorrow, but soon or late she'll tell the truth. If Sir Balin is allowed to carry tales back to King's Landing, drums will sound and blood will flow. He should not be allowed to leave.
We could kill him, to be sure, said Tyene. But then we would need to kill the rest of his party, too, even those sweet young squires. That would be, oh, so messy. Prince Doran shut his eyes and opened them again. Hotar could see his leg trembling underneath the blanket. If you were not my brother's daughters, I would send the three of you back to your cells and keep you there until your bones were grey. Instead, I mean to take you with us to the water gardens. There are lessons there, if you have the wit to see them.
Lessons, said Obara, all I've seen are naked children.
Aye, the prince said, I told the story to Sir Balin, but not all of it. As the children splashed in the pools, Daenerys watched from amongst the orange trees, and a realization came to her. She could not tell the highborn from the low. Naked, they were only children, all innocent, all vulnerable, all deserving of long life, love, protection. There is your realm, she told her son and heir. Remember them in everything you do. My own mother said those same words to me when I was old enough to leave the pools. It is an easy thing for a prince to call the spears, but in the end, the children pay the price. For their sake, the wise prince will wage no war without good cause, nor any war he cannot hope to win. I am not blind, nor deaf. I know that you all believe me weak, frightened, feeble. Your father knew me better. Oberyn was ever the viper, deadly, dangerous, unpredictable. No man dared tread on him. I was the grass, pleasant, complacent, sweet-smelling, swaying with every breeze. Who fears to walk upon the grass? But it is the grass that hides the viper from his enemies and shelters him until he strikes. Your father and I worked more closely than you know. But now he's gone. The question is, can I trust his daughters to serve me in his place? Hotar studied each of them in turn. Obara, rusted nails and boiled leather, with her angry, close-set eyes and rat-brown hair. Nymeria, languid, elegant, olive-skinned, her long black braid bound up in red-gold wire. Tyene, blue-eyed and blonde, a child-woman, with her soft hands and little giggles. Tyene answered for the three of them. It is doing nothing that is hard, uncle. Set a task for us, any task, and you shall find us as leal and obedient as any prince could hope for. That is good to hear, the prince said, but words are wind. You are my brother's daughters, and I love you, but I have learned I cannot trust you. I want your oath. Will you swear to serve me to do as I command? If we must, said Lady Nym, then swear it now, upon your father's grave. Obara's face darkened. If you are not my uncle, I am your uncle, and your prince. Swear or go. I swear, said Tyene, on my father's grave. I swear, said Lady Nym, by Oberyn Martell, the Red Viper of Dawn, and a better man than you. I, said Obara, me as well. By father, I swear. Some of the tension went out of the prince. Hotar saw him sag back into his chair. He held out his hand, and Princess Ariane moved to his side to hold it. Tell them, father. Prince Doran took a jagged breath. Dorne still has friends at court. Friends who tell us things we were not meant to know. This invitation Cersei sent us is a ruse. Tristane is never meant to reach King's Landing. On the road back, somewhere in the King's Wood,
Sir Balin's party will be attacked by outlaws, and my son will die. I am asked to court only so that I may witness this attack with my own eyes, and thereby absolve the queen of any blame. Oh, and these outlaws, they will be shouting, "Half-man! Half-man!" as they attack. Sir Balin may even catch a quick glimpse of the imp, though no one else will. Arya Hotar would not have believed it possible to shock the Sand Snakes. He would have been wrong.
"Seven save us," whispered Tyene. "Tristan, why?"
"The woman must be mad," Obara said. "He's just a boy."
"This is monstrous," said Lady Nim.
"I would not have believed it, not of a Kingsguard knight."
"They are sworn to obey, just as my captain is," the prince said.
"I had my doubts as well, but you all saw how Sir Balin balked when I suggested that we go by sea. A ship would have disturbed all the queen's arrangements."
Obara's face was flushed.
"Give me back my spear, uncle. Cersei sent us ahead. We should send her back a bag of them."
Prince Doran raised a hand. His knuckles were as dark as cherries and near as big.
"Sir Balin is a guest beneath my roof. He has eaten of my bread and salt. I will not do him harm. No. We will travel to the water gardens, where he will hear Myrcella's story and send a raven to his queen. The girl will ask him to hunt down the man who hurt her. If he is a man I judge, Swan will not be able to refuse. Obara, you will lead him to High Hermitage to beard Darkstar in his den. The time has not yet come for Dorne to openly defy the Iron Throne, so we must needs return Myrcella to her mother. But I will not be accompanying her. That task will be yours, Nymeria. The Lannisters will not like it, no more than they liked it when I sent them Oberyn, but they dare not refuse. We need a voice in council, an heir at court. Be careful, though. King's Landing is a pit of snakes." Lady Nym smiled.
"Why, uncle, I love snakes."
"And what of me?" asked Tyene. "Your mother was a scepter. Oberyn once told me that she read to you in the cradle from the seven-pointed star. I want you in King's Landing, too, but on the other hill. The swords and the stars have been reformed, and this new High Septon is not the puppet that the others were. Try and get close to him."
"Why not? White suits my colouring. I look so pure."
"Good," the prince said. "Good." He hesitated. If certain things should come to pass, I will send word to each of you. Things can change quickly in the Game of Thrones."
"I know you will not fail us, cousins." Arianne went to each of them in turn, took their hands, kissed them lightly on the lips. "Obara, so fierce. Nymeria, my sister. Tyene, sweetling. I love you all. The Son of Dawn goes with you. Unbowed, unbent, unbroken,"
the Sand Snakes said together. Princess Arianne lingered when her cousins had departed. Arya Hotar remained as well, as was his place.
"They are their father's daughters," the prince said.
The little princess smiled.
"Three Oberons with teats."
Prince Doran laughed. It had been so long since Hotar last heard him laugh. He had almost forgotten what it sounded like.
"I still say it should be me who goes to King's Landing, not Lady Nym," Arianne said.
"It is too dangerous. You are my heir, the future of Dawn. Your place is by my side. Soon enough you'll have another task."
"That last part about the message, have you had tidings?"
Prince Doran shared his secret smile with her. "From Lys, a great fleet has put in there to take on water. Volunteer ships chiefly, carrying an army. No word as to who they are or where they might be bound. There was talk of elephants.
No dragons.
Elephants. Easy enough to hide a young dragon in a big cog's hole, though. Daenerys is most vulnerable at sea. If I were her, I would keep myself and my intentions hidden as long as I could, so I might take King's Landing unawares.
Do you think Quentin will be with them?
He could be, or not. We will know by where they land, if Westeros is indeed their destination. Quentin will bring her up the green blood, if he can. But it does no good to speak of it. Kiss me. We leave for the water gardens at first light.
We may depart by midday, then, Hotar thought.
Later, when Arianne had gone, he put down his long axe and lifted Prince Doran into his bed. Until the mountain crushed my brother's skull, no Dornishman had died in this war of the Five Kings, the prince murmured softly, as Hotar pulled a blanket over him.
Tell me, Captain, is that my shame or my glory?
That is not for me to say, my prince. Serve, protect, obey. Simple vows for simple men.
That was all he knew. Tyrion. A horse whickered impatiently behind him from amidst the ranks of gold cloaks drawn up across the road. Tyrion could hear Lord Giles coughing as well. He had not asked for Giles, no more than he had asked for Sir Adam or Jalabar Zo or any of the rest, but his lord father felt Doran Martell might take it ill if only a dwarf came out to escort him across the Blackwater.
Joffrey should have met the Dornishman himself, he reflected as he sat waiting. But he would have mucked it up, no doubt.
Of late, the king had been repeating little jests about the Dornish that he'd picked up from Mace Tyrell's men-at-arms.
How many Dornishmen does it take to shoe a horse?
9. 1 to do the shoeing, and 8 to lift the horse up. Somehow, Tyrion did not think Doran Martell would find that amusing. He could see their banners flying as the riders emerged from the green of the living wood in a long, dusty column. From here to the river, only bare black trees remained, a legacy of his battle.
Too many banners, he thought sourly, as he watched the ashes kick up under the hooves of the approaching horses, as they had beneath the hooves of the Tyrell van, as it smashed Stannis in the flank. Martell's brought half the Lords of Dawn, by the look of it.
He tried to think of some good that might come of that, and failed.
How many banners do you count?
He asked Bronn.
The sellsword knight shaded his eyes. 8? No, 9.
Tyrion turned in the saddle.
Pod, come up here. Describe the arms you see, and tell me which houses they represent.
Podrick Payne edged his gelding closer. He was carrying the royal standard, Joffrey's great stag and lion, and struggling with its weight. Bronn bore Tyrion's own banner, the Lion of Lannister, gold on crimson.
He's getting taller, Tyrion realized, as Pod stood in his stirrups for a better view. He'll soon tower over me, like all the rest.
The lad had been making a diligent study of Dornish heraldry at Tyrion's command, but as ever he was nervous.
I can't see, the wind is flapping them.
Bronn, tell the boy what you see. Bronn looked very much the knight today, in his new doublet and cloak, the flaming chain across his chest.
A red sun on orange, he called, with a spear through its back.
Martell,
Podrick Payne said at once, visibly relieved.
House Martell of Sunspear, my lord, the Prince of Dawn.
My horse would have known that one, said Tyrion dryly.
Give him another, Bronn. There's a purple flag with yellow balls.
Lemons, Pod said hopefully. A purple field strewn with lemons for House Dort of Lemonwood.
Might be. Next, a big black bird on yellow. Something pink or white in its claws.
are to say with a banner flapping? The vulture of Blackmont grasps a baby in its talons, said Pod. House Blackmont of Blackmont, sir.
Bronn laughed. Reading books again? Books will ruin your sword eye, boy. I see a skull too. A black banner.
The crown skull of House Manwoody, bone and gold on black.
Pod sounded more confident with every correct answer.
The Manwoodies of King's Grave.
Three black spiders.
They're scorpions, sir. House Corgill of Sandstone. Three scorpions, black on red.
Red and yellow, a jagged line between.
The flames of Hellholt. House Allah.
Tyrion was impressed. The boy is not half stupid once he gets his tongue untied. Go on, Pod, he urged. If you get them all, I'll make you a gift. A pie with red and black slices, said Bronn. There's a gold and in the middle.
House Illyrian of God's Grace.
A red chicken eating a snake, looks like.
The Gargalians of Salt Shore. A cockatrice, sir, pardon, not a chicken. Red with a black snake in its beak.
Very good, exclaimed Tyrion. One more, lad. Bronn scanned the ranks of the approaching Dornishmen. The lush, a golden feather on green checks.
A golden quill, sir, Jordane of the Tor.
Tyrion laughed. Nine, and well done. I could not have named them all myself. That was a lie, but it would give the boy some pride, and that he badly needed.
Martell brings some formidable companions, it would seem.
Not one of the houses Pod had named was small or insignificant. Nine of the greatest lords of Dorne were coming up the King's Road, them or their heirs, and somehow Tyrion did not think they had come all this way just to see the Dancing Bear. There was a message here, and not one that I like. He wondered if it had been a mistake to ship Myrcella down to Sunspear.
My lord, Pod said a little timidly, there's no letter.
Tyrion turned his head sharply. The boy was right.
Doran Martell always travels in a litter, the boy said, a carved litter with silk hangings and suns on the drapes.
Tyrion had heard the same talk. Prince Doran was past 50 and gouty. He may have wanted to make faster time, he told himself. He may have feared his litter would make too tempting a target for brigands, or that it would prove too cumbersome in the high passes of the Boneway. Perhaps his gout is better. So why did he have such a bad feeling about this? This waiting was intolerable. Banners, forward! He snapped. We'll meet them! He kicked his horse. Bronn and Pod followed, one to either side. When the Dornishmen saw them coming, they spurred their own mounts, banners rippling as they rode. From their ornate saddles were slung the round metal shields they favoured, and many carried bundles of short throwing spears, or the double-curved Dornish bows they used so well from horseback. There were three sorts of Dornishmen, the first King Daeron had observed. There were the salty Dornishmen, who lived along the coasts, the sandy Dornishmen of the deserts and long river valleys, and the stony Dornishmen who made their fastnesses in the passes and heights of the Red Mountains. The salty Dornishmen had the most roynish blood, the stony Dornishmen the least. All three sorts seemed very well represented in Doran's retinue. The salty Dornishmen were lithe and dark, with smooth olive skin and long black hair streaming in the wind. The sandy Dornishmen were even darker, their faces burned brown by the hot Dornish sun. They wound long bright scarves around their helms to ward off sunstroke. The stony Dornishmen were the biggest and fairest, sons of the Andals and the First Men, brown-haired or blonde, with faces that freckled or burned in the sun instead of browning. The lords wore silk and satin robes with jewelled belts and flowing sleeves. Their armour was heavily enamelled and inlaid with burnished copper, shining silver, and soft red gold. They came astride red horses and golden ones, and a few as pale as snow, all slim and swift, with long necks and narrow, beautiful heads.
The fabled sand steeds of Dorne were smaller than proper war horses and could not bear such weight of armour, but it was said they could run for a day and night and another day and never tire. The Dornish leader forked a stallion black as sin with a mane and tail the colour of fire.